Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Shekman. The foreign policy debate in this campaign, or more specifically, the lack thereof, along with the recent terror attacks, have brought into bold relief the simple fact that the world changed after 9/11 in ways that seemed to create fundamental fissures in the international architecture that had been in place since the Second World War. Eisenhower admonished us about a powerful military-industrial complex. That complex and its attendant institutions thrived during the Cold War. But with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the need for that raw power and for American empire seemed to disappear. We were at what Francis Fukuyama called the end of history. And then 9/11, the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, events in Lebanon and Syria, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, etc., all set up a chain of events that now has us seemingly in endless war in the Middle East. Add to this the fear generated by terrorism, and suddenly the need for American hegemony is rekindled. The need for more and more advanced weaponry is stoked. The revolving door between the Pentagon and defense contractors turns even faster. Generals now in bed with the media, and not the other way around. And presidential candidates openly advocate torture and violations of international treaties and are applauded for it. In the words of Yeats, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passion and intensity. My guest, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, is that rare specimen, one of the best that still maintains that passionate intensity. He was, as they say, present at the creation. As the chief of staff to former Secretary of State Colin Powell, he helped Powell make the case for the overthrow of Saddam in 2003. Today, he looks back on those decisions as a turning point not only for his view of the world, but for the world itself. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson spent 31 years in the U.S. Army. He was a former Army Ranger who flew over 1,000 combat missions in Vietnam. He was National Security Advisor in the Reagan administration and later served with Powell during his time on the Joint Chiefs and as Secretary of State. He's currently an adjunct professor at the College of William and Mary. And it is my pleasure to welcome Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson to Radio Who, What, Why. Colonel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
When we look back, it's been 13 years now since we went to war and invaded Iraq based upon what we now know to be cherry-picked intelligence and false premises and hidden agendas. As you look back on that, do you see clear threads, clear lines that go from those decisions to the problems and to the reality that we see in the world today?
I do. And they disturbed me greatly. They disturbed me not just for the livelihood and prosperity of this federal republic in which we live, but also its influence on the rest of the world and ultimately the rest of the world. I think what we're seeing today, your summary was quite good. I think what we're seeing today are the manifestations of the inability of the empire, if you will, and we are an empire. Different empire, perhaps, not necessarily an empire of territorial aggrandizement, although we have 900-plus installations all over the world looking like the new Rome, but more an empire of ideology and what I would call commercialism. We forget that very important commerce clause in our Constitution, which some have argued is the most important and self-identifying clause in our Constitution. The empire has spawned a lot of this mess by its own actions and its own inability to get its act together, if you will, post end of the Cold War. Think about it for a moment. We have not had a strategy since the end of the Cold War. If you want to say our strategy for World War II was to be the arsenal of democracy, we fulfill that splendidly, supplying the Russians, the Free French, the British, everyone on our side in the war. And then afterwards, containment to keep the Soviet empire from dominating the world. Well, since the end of that time, now over two-plus decades ago, we've had no strategy. And what's filled in for that lack of a strategy, for that lack of leadership, has been things like what you just described. Let's look at what we've done with the reality of the situation since 9/11. We have spent close to $2 trillion combating a threat that has, as the Cato Institute pointed out recently, the mathematical probability of killing one of us that roughly equates to a lightning strike or falling down a staircase. How do we get the American people to be so quiescent, so ignorant, so lacking in energy that they tolerate that kind of expenditure against that kind of threat? And yet, that's what we've done. Complicit in that is our media, corporately owned and corporately directed. Complicit in that is the, as you pointed out, awesome military-industrial complex, which just makes huge profits off this. Kellogg, Brown & Root, Halliburton's principal subsidiary in Iraq and Afghanistan in those years of war you just described, made over $40 billion. When you have people making those kinds of profits off killing other people for state purposes, you're going to have a lot more of that killing. So it's a mess, and it's a mess that in many respects we have responsibility for. We and our allies who have simply put this status quo power arrangement on fast forward and have no idea how to get out of it, how to escape from it, and how to redesign the world so it's more peaceful, more prosperous, and ultimately a better place for all of us to live.
One of the ironies in all of this goes to the heart of what you're talking about with respect to no strategy. That even if the events that led up to the invasion of Iraq had some kind of hidden agenda, or as the Downing Street memo points out, were things that were in the planning stages or the talking stages for so long, it is hard to imagine that given all of that, that happened without any kind of strategy, without any kind of thought to what happens after.
I think you're right, and I think I would not, as a military person, you know, professionally steeped in the terms tactics, strategy, operations, I would say what we've been doing is tactical. We've had no strategy against which to place those tactics, and so anyone who wants to flow in, who has an agenda like, you know, the Project for a New American Century, the neoconservatives, whomever you want to point your finger at any given time, flows into that lack of a strategy, that lack of leadership, captures the system for a moment or two, and does what it wants to do with awesome power, our power. And no one's standing around saying, hey, that's not right, let's stop that. Look at the present political campaigns on both sides. On my side, the Republican side, it's an absolute circus. On the Democratic side, it's more the same. I'm not sure which is worse. I do not see leadership, genuine leadership, ready to confront the dire challenges that the 21st century is offering us, at the head of which is planetary climate change. I don't see the kind of leadership that's necessary to carry us through that and bring us out on the other side feeling pretty good about ourselves and having a reasonably decent life for the majority of our people. That's what it's all about. What I see is people flowing into the gaps, flowing into the lack of leadership, flowing into the circus, for example, that you see people like Donald Trump on my party's side of the campaign for the presidency in November. What I see is tactics, and those tactics are not aimed much at anything except the amassing of wealth for a very select few of people, and that, frankly, is not going to do the rest of us much good at all. In fact, it's going to be harmful to us.
Which also brings us back to the events leading up to Iraq, to events in 2003. In trying to understand what the underlying motivation was, what the underlying strategy or tactics were with respect to the administration, and one of the things that you've pointed out over the years is really a change in position that took place with respect to Dick Cheney. If you go back to 1994, he was very much opposed to going into Baghdad. What changed, and what do we understand about that change and where it's led us today?
You're right. If you listen to Dick Cheney in 94, it's almost stunning to think about Dick Cheney in 2001, 2, and 3. It almost looks as if something physiological happened to him, as if, not to put too fine a point on it, as if he went nuts. And believe it or not, I've had neurosurgeons actually email me and tell me that there are a lot of things associated with the kind of heart condition he had and then a heart transplant and so forth that might corroborate that. But if you want to look at it, I think from the perspective you're talking about, I think Cheney had in mind the strategic objective, which was a long-term objective of the United States, begun by FDR when he met with the Saudi princes and established essentially the relationship, the foundation of the relationship we'd have with Saudi Arabia, and continued very, very vocally by Jimmy Carter when he proclaimed that the Persian Gulf was a vital interest of the United States. All of that was about oil. It was all about oil, not just for us, but for Japan, for England, for France, for Germany, for our NATO allies, and so forth. And that's what Cheney discovered in his Energy Task Force papers, which we still do not have a copy of. They're declared executive privilege, and we don't know what happened. But he met with all the leaders of the majors, the privates, the nationals, and so forth, and others associated with the petroleum industry. And I think he decided those 300, maybe even 400 billion barrels of oil under the Iraqi desert, second only to Saudi Arabia, maybe even surpassing Saudi Arabia once Western technology has explored Iraq thoroughly, were worth the war, but he couldn't get the American people to do it. He couldn't get his president to do it without a imminent threat, you know, and so he manufactured the threat. Now, people have asked me, well, why didn't the privates fall in on Iraq? Well, some of them did, but the purpose of this action, they misconstrue. Most Americans misconstrue it. It's not to grab the oil for ExxonMobil or Royal Dutch Shell or any of the other privates. What it is to ensure access to oil at a reasonable price consistently over time. That's what it's been since FDR met with the Saudis, and that's what Dick Cheney was continuing. I don't think it was against a major strategy for running the situation, for managing power in the world, I guess is the best way to put it. I think it was just more of the same. That's what great powers do. They fight desperately to preserve the status quo. They want the legacy systems to continue to exist, World Bank, IMF, you name it, whatever we created post-World War II. Well, I've got news for them. There are plenty of people out there who are writing very eloquently and thinking critically about these institutions being anachronisms. They're not good enough for the 21st century. They need to evolve. We need new systems. We need new ways of global governance, for example. And one of the most prescient people in this regard is Thomas Piketty, the French economist who wrote the book Capital in the 21st Century. He may be a little bit utopian in the sense that he's suggesting a solution is a global tax on capital, but I'll tell you what, I don't see any way else to combat this massive accumulation of capital around the world, which is going to no real economic purpose, that is to say the middle classes and the lower classes. It's going to no economic purpose other than to continue to fill the coffers of the filthy 1% or less than 1% of the wealthiest people in the world. You know, when you have 400 people in the United States who have the wealth of the GDP of the state of Brazil, you've got a real problem with concentrated wealth. Piketty's solution might not be the one we adopt, but we need to adopt something to get this capital back into the system, working to raise wages, to make meaningful products, to sell them, to have a system in the world that works for the majority of the people rather than for a select few. These are huge problems that demand first-class leadership, first-class strategy from that leadership, and first-class execution of that strategy. And look at what we have arrayed before us at this moment to pick for leaders.
What do you see then as the nexus between those issues with respect to the economic condition of the world, as you talk about it, and this constantly growing, geometrically growing cost of endless war?
It's staggering what we're doing to ourselves. We need two, maybe three, some have even said, and I've seen studies that would corroborate their thoughts, $4 trillion. To refurbish our infrastructure in this country. And I'm talking everything from water to sewage to roads to the air FAA facility. I'm talking about everything that makes this economy and this country tick. That's what I'm talking about. And I'm not talking about putting the same thing in place. I'm talking about putting things in place that will be resilient, sustainable, and last to the end of the 21st century or beyond. I'm talking about an entirely new industrial base, agricultural base, you name it. If there's a major segment of what we do, it needs refurbishing and it needs pointing towards the future, not the past. Look at what we're doing. We're spending that necessary money on wars and wars with no real purpose. We're spending it on things that make no sense whatsoever, except in the old legacy sense of Well, empires have to protect their periphery. They have to extend that periphery. They have to fight all over the world. This is what brought Rome to its knees. You've got to do that sort of thing. That's embedded in our heads. And what should be embedded in our heads is take a look at the future. Take a look at what you've got to do. Take a look at things like sea rise, for example. I belong to something called the Climate Security Working Group here in Washington. It's a DOD outfit. The Department of Defense understands what sea rise is going to do to this country over the next 50, 60 years. Here in my home state of Virginia, Norfolk, they're going to have to make a decision to build seawalls or to relocate the greatest shipyard building facilities and associated logistics in this country, because they're going to be flooded if they don't. These are the kinds of problems we need to be confronting. This is where we need to be spending our money and placing our effort. And we're not. Instead, we're doing these silly-ass wars all over the world. I'm sorry. My heart goes out to the civil war in Syria and the victims thereof. But largely, we produced that with the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Now we're talking about us having to put troops there and so forth. That's patent nonsense. We're going to bankrupt ourselves. We're going to wind up going the way Rome went, and for that matter, the way every empire in human history has gone. We're going to disappear.
When we look back at the events that brought us into Iraq originally and our lax defense against al-Qaeda, our not taking the threats from bin Laden seriously, or at least the administration not paying attention to the threats that were out there, it's both easy to see how that happened and hard to imagine us getting out of it if something like that could happen even 13 years ago.
And yet, I was just in Austin, Texas. I went out to Austin to premiere a film, a documentary called Embargo, mm-hmm. which is about the Cuban embargo. And I'm at a house in Austin, fairly wealthy people, and a good old Texas lady comes up to me. She's my age. She's probably 68, 69, 70. She comes up to me and she says, "I want to ask you a question, Colonel." I said, "Yes, ma'am. Ask me the question." She said, "I want to know why we are such cowards." I said, "Ma'am?" She said, "I want to know why we're such cowards, and I want to assure you we here in Texas are not cowards. Why are we spending so much money going after these terrorists when the chance of one of us getting killed by one of these terrorists is slim to none? And if it is going to come to Texas, and if they are going to kill me, by God, I'm going to fight them here. And I'll fight them at my house, and I'll fight them in the shopping centers. So why are we so scared?" Wow, what clarity she brought to the issue.
You mentioned the film you were involved in, Embargoed, which really is about another throwback to the days of the Cold War and American Empire, and that's been our outdated policy towards Cuba.
Well, I'm very happy to see that the work I've been involved in the last 10 years with some other very, very dedicated people has come to fruition, and at least partly we were conducting what we call track two diplomacy with the Cubans, blessed by the U.S. government, blessed by the government in Havana. And we were meeting in Buenos Aires and Sao Paulo, Brazil, and Mexico City and Toronto, Canada, and in Havana. We couldn't meet in Washington because we couldn't get any visas, which was laughable. And we turned our work over to the Assistant Secretary of State for the Western Hemisphere. And we now have closer relations and a president who actually traveled to Havana. I hope this signals the end to a very stupid foreign policy towards Havana. After the end of the Cold War, Havana stopped exporting revolution in the name of communism and started exporting doctors and medical technicians in the name of helping people in very impoverished areas. They were so successful in Pakistan, for example, during the earthquake in 2006 that then-President Musharraf asked them to establish an embassy in Islamabad. That's the best public diplomacy anyone's conducted in a long time. So we do need, it's past time, to have better relations with Cuba. We need to lift the embargo, too. This is one of those legacy policies that I was referring to that makes absolutely no sense in the 21st century. And I hope we've reversed it. A similar one is the joint cooperative agreement with Iran over the nuclear program, over Iran's nuclear program, with the U.S., the European Union, the Permanent Five, and the United Nations and Germany. Iran is the most stable country in a very unstable region, Southwest Asia. It has more democratic tendencies than any country in the region other than Israel. It has a 70-plus million, very homogeneous population. It is huge compared to Iraq. It dwarfs Iraq. It is the hegemon, natural hegemon, if you will, in the Persian Gulf region in Southwest Asia. We need to have better relations with it. But look at how my party in particular, but some Democrats are, too, are fighting that even. You come up with a sane policy like Cuba. You come up with a sane policy like some sort of rapprochement with Iran. And what do you get? You get this almost Cretan-like, Luddite-like opposition from many in the Congress. There just isn't any leadership in the city where I live, Washington, D.C.
And yet those two things, the improvement of relationships with Cuba, the president's recent trip there, and the agreement with Iran, both of those are very positive developments. Even though there are, as you say, strong voices of opposition, those two things alone should give us pause that progress can happen.
You're right, and I've got both my fingers and my toes crossed. I watch every day as the Congress tries to derail the Iran agreement. Right now they're working on a sanctions package in addition to what's already there that will be a break of the agreement. And if I were the Iranians, I would leave the agreement if the sanctions package actually passes the Congress and the president doesn't veto it. And that's why it's so important who we elect next. Do we continue this or do we go back to the past again? And with the same thing, though not quite as virulent with Cuba, we've got people who are trying desperately to figure a way to fashion a way back to the past. But you're right. Basically, these are hopeful things. And I for one, hope that there are some others. We need desperately to get over the problems we have with Russia, because Russia is so integral to other major policy objectives we have in the world, whether it be some hedging strategy to deal with a China that comes off the rails, or whether it be Iran, Syria, the civil war there, or Turkey, or whatever. If we don't have Russia at least with us on some of these things, we have an impossible situation. I think we've seen that in Syria to a certain extent, although what Putin has done in Syria has as much as anything else that has been done there made possible the current prospects for a ceasefire and political talks and maybe finally an end to the war in Syria. So Moscow and Washington need to cooperate more than they need to fight, and yet we see what we're seeing with regard to Crimea, Ukraine, Georgia, and so forth, all of which basically is our fault. Most Americans haven't a clue that George H.W. Bush, a president whom I served, and his Secretary of State, Jim Baker, promised Gorbachev, then the leader of the Soviet Union, cum Russia, that if he, Gorbachev, acceded to the reunification of Germany and its maintaining, its being retained in the NATO alliance, contemplating Georgia, Ukraine, and so forth, and along comes George W. Bush and actually goes to Tbilisi, Georgia, and tells the leaders there in open comment in the public that soon Georgia will be a member of NATO. Well, one understands why Putin would make a move in Georgia and then later make a move in Ukraine and the Crimea. We threatened him. It's as if he had come to the Gulf of Mexico, maybe the state of Chihuahua or whatever, and said, well, you know, I think I'll just foment a revolution here and I'll make these people anti-U.S. I mean, it's crazy what we've done. It's absolutely insane what we've done when we need Russia to be cooperative in various and sundry areas that are far more important than some of the things we've done. And then I'd throw this out, too. If you talk about legacy systems, look at NATO. We've gone from 19 to 24. Now I think we're at 28. What American is going to really back a president who invokes Article 5, which simply says in the NATO treaty an attack on one is an attack on all, for Tbilisi, Georgia? What American wants to die for Tbilisi, Georgia? It's insane what we've done with NATO. It's supposed to be a military as well as a political alliance. Well, if you don't have people in the country that is the most powerful member of NATO who understand what obligation they're taking on, then you got a real problem when someone challenges that alliance.
Is there a positive role for leaders in the military to play in beginning to turn this around?
Oh, absolutely. You know, your opening comments resonated with me in that one of the big problems we've got is the General Officer Corps, the Flag Officer Corps. That includes admirals, of course, in the Navy and the Coast Guard, who go through this revolving door and exacerbate the problem we have with the military-industrial complex and with the media. Some of them do both. They go work for a member of the Defense Contracting Corps. At the same time, they're a consultant for CNN or whatever. So they have these maximum amount of dollars coming into themselves being paid for these duties. But they're also dangerous to the Republic because they're doing things like fomenting this warfare. That's very disturbing. But in terms of the leadership in general, the younger officers in particular, and that I would say is colonels on down, but particularly in the middle ranks, the lieutenant colonels, majors, and captains, there's a real angst on their part about, one, this constant warfare, two, the senior leaders whom they don't have a lot of respect for, and three, the fact that the military seems to be stuck in these legacy systems, too. There's a Marine Colonel, T.X. Ham, who's just written an article that's points at this. We have so many legacy systems out there. Think about the F-35 Lightning Strike Fighter, the new aircraft carrier we just fielded, $12 billion+. Think about the new bomber for the Air Force, and think about Ohio class and attack submarines and so forth. These are all systems that are incremental improvements on legacy strategies. That is to say, you're spending billions of dollars to add very, very, very small increments to your national security. Well, at the same time all this is happening, new techniques, new technology like robotics, artificial intelligence, cyber warfare, 3D printing, are permitting things to be made and to be accessible to small powers in the world. I'm not talking China's and Russia's. I'm talking small powers. I'm talking about something like, for example, ISIS. If they were to get their hands on one of these $100,000 cost 3D printers that can actually make something overnight, literally overnight, that they can then put in the air, put in the ocean or other atmosphere, and they can take on your multi-billion dollar system and perhaps destroy it. We just had a drone, for example, underwater drone, that went from the east coast of the United States to the coast of Europe. Underwater, all by itself. Think about hanging some weapons or some mines, very sophisticated weapons and mines, on that $100,000 drone and going after a $4 billion Ohio-class submarine or an attack submarine at $1 billion and sinking it. This is the revolution in military affairs that people have been talking about so long that is finally upon us with AI, with robotics, with nanoengineering, and so forth and so on. We're not doing much about that. We've got people working on the side. We've got little groups here and there and so forth. So we're keeping our hand in. But we're still building these billion-dollar legacy systems that are going to be anachronisms if they aren't already momentarily. And that's going to be traumatic. And the younger guys in the military and gals in the military, they understand this. And they sit back and look at the senior leadership, which doesn't understand it, keeps going for these legacy systems and so forth. And many of them are voting with their feet. That's a problem. We're losing a lot of junior officers right now because of that.
What does that say about how focused we should be then on terrorism and asymmetrical threats around the world?
I think I wouldn't put the name terrorism on it. I've personally had real problems with that when we did in 2001 because I said, how do you fight a method? You know, you can't fight a method. And it's like the drug war. I also argued against calling it the drug war to no avail. But I said, why would you want to have something be a war that you can't win? And you can't win the war against terrorism either. Terrorism has been with us for 4 or 5 millennia. Is going to be with us for another 4 or 5 millennia if we survive that long. So what you want to do is you take things like drugs, take things like terrorists, and you want to push them down to a manageable level. You want to push them down to where they aren't haunting you every day and the media doesn't focus on them every day and so forth, and they're not doing that much damage. But you're never going to get rid of them. They're always going to be there as long as there's someone willing to take up arms in that name. And I suspect there's always going to be someone. So you need to focus on these bigger problems as you were creating the management process of keeping terrorism and other threats like that, drugs and so forth, in check. If you don't, you're going to wind up one morning waking up with Wolf Blitzer on the Situation Room on CNN screaming and hollering about an attack in Paris or an attack in Beirut, and you're going to turn around and your country's going to explode. And it isn't going to be terrorists that do it. It's going to be something else that you've neglected that was much bigger, much more of a problem, much more dangerous, and your focus on terrorism took your focus off that.
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, I thank you so much for spending time with us today on Radio Who, What, Why.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you'll join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share it and help other people find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.